My name is Jackie Moulton. I was a detective with the Metropolitan Police for over 25 years. My real life experiences on the front line as a woman investigating crime became the inspiration for the TV drama Prime Suspect. Oh, good morning, Pete. My name's Jackie Moulton. Once a detective, always a detective. It never leaves. And now I'm going back on the road, on the job, and I'm looking at some of the worst crimes ever committed in the UK and the USA. In a series of exclusive interviews, I'll be talking one-to-one to detectives and experts to find out how they brought the killer to justice. This is the story of what it takes to find the real prime suspect. In my experience, any murder is shocking, but the case I'm looking at this time is almost impossible to understand. The killing of a mother, Rachel Entwistle, and her baby daughter, Lillian, by her own husband in January 2006. This was no crime of passion. British-born Neil Entwistle killed his wife in cold blood, then fled their home in the US. To return to the UK. There seemed no apparent motive for the murder, leaving the family of the victims utterly bewildered and devastated by what he did. I've flown to Boston, the location of this case, to find out how investigators on the ground pieced together what happened and what lay at the root of this incomprehensible of crimes.
The Neil Entwistle case is really tragic. Here was a family living the American dream in a suburb of Boston called Hopkinton. Beautiful house. To all intents and purposes, happily married couple with a nine-month-old baby. It's tragic because the bodies of Rachel and Lillian were found dead in bed. Entwistle had driven to Logan Airport in Boston, caught a one-way ticket back to the UK, left his hired car at Boston Airport, and never returned for the family's funeral. This is a case that was kind of fairly new to me. I heard a little bit about it in the press. So I'm really fascinated to find out why a man like Entwistle would murder his wife and his own nine-month-old baby. So I've got a lot of people to interview, the forensic scientists, the detectives from Hopkinton, the district attorney. So I'm hoping that they're going to unravel for me the story of Entwistle and why he did what he did.
On January the 20th, 2006, Priscilla Matarazzo called police in Hopkinton, an affluent suburb of Boston. She was concerned that her daughter Rachel had not been in touch for several days. All attempts to locate her had failed.
Hi, this is Priscilla Matarazzo. I'm calling because my daughter moved to Hopkinton about a week ago.
Yes.
I haven't heard from her in 2 days, and I was up there today. She was expecting me. There was nobody there, and I just heard from her girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
She was expecting for supper tonight, and there's no one there. We can't reach her by cell phone, and it's really unusual for her to do this.
The last time you spoke with her, everything seemed all right. She didn't tell you that she was going away unexpectedly or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
She's the type of girl that calls me whenever she does anything.
Sure. Okay. And well, yep. Okay. Right? We'll send somebody up. We'll check it, and then I'll give you a call back and let you know how we make out.
All right. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. You're entirely welcome. Bye.
Local officers went to the Entwistle's home to carry out a well-being check to see if there were any problems. They entered the house, but this cursory check only revealed that the family were not there. In a respectable neighbourhood like this, there was no reason to suspect anything bad had happened. To find out more about what happened next, I want to meet Detective Sergeant Scott Van Relton from the Hopkinton Police.
Hello, Scott. This is Jackie Moulton, formerly of the Metropolitan Police in London. I'm in Boston re-examining the case of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle. Would you have time to talk to me about the case, please?
Hi, Jackie. Yes, I'd like to speak to you in regards to the Entwistle case. Look forward to speaking with you. Thank you.
Scott, on the 22nd of January 2006, you were a detective at Hopkinton Police and reported for duty that day. Can you tell me what happened? It was a Sunday, I understand.
It was Sunday evening. I reviewed the logs from the daily logs from my days off and had seen that there was a missing persons case on Saturday, the day prior. I spoke with the officers involved, asking about any follow-up that we should be doing. And it was determined that it was pretty suspicious that a whole family was missing. I had made a decision that we would go back to the neighborhood, re-enter the house, and spend a little bit more time looking for anything that was out of place or indications of where they may have gone.
So I understand, Scott, that when the mother reported the daughter, no reply, that the police had done a cursory search of the house, a well-being check the day before, and not noticed anything.
That's correct. So the officers on Saturday evening had entered the house and done a search, and it's a real quick search, basically poking your head in every room, making sure that there isn't somebody laying on the ground in need of medical assistance. So knowing that they'd already done that and they had found nothing, myself and the sergeant entered the house while the other officers were talking to the neighbors. And we entered the master bedroom and everything looked normal. We both had noticed that when we were coming up the staircase to the second floor that there was a strange odor. That odor wasn't there the night prior. We thought it was like dirty diapers. We pulled the covers back. We saw Rachel Entwistle laying on her back and the baby Lillian laying on the left side of her chest with a bunch of pillows around them. It was obvious to us that there were signs of death, that there was nothing that we could do medically for them at this time. And at this time, we treated it as a crime scene.
Could you tell at that point that they, or how they had been killed?
I could not. At that time, we had believed, because of the amount of pillows that were around them, that maybe they had been suffocated or a pillow had been put over their face. But we didn't see anything else. There was no excessive blood. There was no round casings from the firearm on the ground anywhere. So we were really unsure of how they had died. We covered them back up, and we searched the rest of the house to include the attic, basement, everything outside, looking for Neil Entwistle to see if he had been a victim also. When we determined that the entire house was clear, that's when I had made notification to my chief of police. I called in the state police, and I also contacted the medical examiner.
The findings of the police team so far had been incredibly shocking, and the horrifying details of the crime they uncovered was totally at odds with the quiet, affluent suburb of Hopkinton. To get a feel for the crime scene myself, Scott Van Relton has agreed to meet me there.
This beautiful area that we're in now, this cul-de-sac, these beautiful houses, it is, to all intents and purposes, the American dream for a young couple and a new baby. In you and I, experience of murder, this would be the last place that one would expect a murder scene to be.
Absolutely. This is very typical of our town. Comfortable homes with property, quiet neighborhood. You'd expect to see kids playing in the streets. Very low traffic and low crime in this area, and it is not something that we're accustomed to.
So presumably they'd only been here 10 days, and we know that lots of boxes hadn't been unpacked. So I doubt if anybody knew who they were here.
The neighbors knew the owners of the house had moved out and the house was up for rent, but they hadn't had a chance to actually meet with the Entwistles and really get to know them. So when we were canvassing the neighborhood, while we believed that they were missing, there was very little information to go on.
When you speak to the officers in the case at length about Neil Entwistle, you know, you can't get a better American dream than this. And for whatever reason it was that he decided that day, within 10 days of this young family moving into this beautiful house, that he should end
his wife's life and that of the baby. What had started out as a mother's concern for the whereabouts of her daughter and grandchild had developed into a full-blown murder investigation. I'm hoping that Detective Captain Mary Ritchie, one of the forensic analysts who attended the scene, can shed more light on the case.
I'm going to visit Mary, the forensic scientist, and talk to her about all of the evidence that they found.
In 2006, Mary Ritchie was a crime scene responder for Massachusetts State Police and a core member of the forensics team called to the murder scene at the Entwistles' home.
Mary Ritchie, we know that Rachel Entwistle and her daughter Lillian were murdered. Can you paint a picture of the crime scene as you saw it in relation to their deaths?
We knew that the victims were already located on the second floor in the master bedroom, and that's the area we wanted to focus on first.
And how was Rachel situated within that bed and her daughter?
Rachel, the mom, was positioned on her left side, and her right arm was across Lillian's chest. Lillian was face up, the infant victim.
And what were the injuries that you saw on both Rachel and Lillian?
When we removed all of those layers, the infant victim was face up, and there was discoloration on her face, some fluid kind of coming from there. It looked like bruising, probably the start of decomposition. And when the mom's arm was moved from the baby's chest, that's when we saw a puncture to the left chest of the infant. Then we realized it was a puncture that appeared to be a gunshot wound.
And there was some allegations by Entwistle's defense team that it was indeed Rachel that had killed Lillian and then turned the gun on herself. But from the position of the bodies that you saw in situ, do you think as a expert crime scene responder that could have been possible?
I don't think so. The wound to the mom's head, it was high up, wasn't until x-ray that we even knew what that was. And she had a puncture to her chest, but it was more of a grazing type puncture. And the clothing had a puncture in it, but I don't know how you would end up in that position after doing that. I don't believe that.
Yeah, and you kind of did describe that Rachel's arm was across the kind of body of her child as if she was protecting
her. Yes, yes.
Yeah. You've been to many crime scenes within your career. Do you ever get triggered by them?
I know they all go up here. They're in here. Some stay with you in a different fashion, though. This was a difficult scene for me. This was difficult. Just the position of the victims and an infant victim, and decomposition had started to set in. There was an odor. Occasionally to this day, you know, when walking by my kids' bedrooms, or, you know, if their comforter's a little puffed up, I have to kind of just give it a little pat down.
And is that the result of that case?
Yes, yes, yes.
Analysis of the crime scene had revealed that both Rachel and her daughter Lillian had been shot at point-blank range. Baby Lillian had been shot in the chest, and Rachel had a single shot wound to the head. What still remained a mystery was the whereabouts of the husband and father of the two victims, Neil Entwistle.
I'm going to phone Bob Manning. He was a detective involved in the investigation of the murder of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle. They were both found dead in their bed, Rachel, the wife of Neil Entwistle, and their nine-month-old baby, Lillian.
In order to trace Neil Entwistle's steps after the murder had taken place, I want to speak to Bob Manning, the Massachusetts State Trooper, who was part of the team tasked with tracking him down.
Hello?
Is that you, Bob?
Yep.
Hi to you, Bob. My name's Jackie Moulton, ex-detective from Scotland Yard. I'm here in Boston, and we need to look at the case of Neil Entwistle. I understand you were the detective in charge of that case. On the 22nd of January 2006, you got a call to go to a house in Hopkinton where the body of Rachel Entwistle and her nine-month-old baby, Lillian, were found dead. Were you aware of the details of the husband of Rachel and where his location was?
Well, not at first. A thorough search was done of the home, and the body, you know, no body, no sign of the husband, Neil Entwistle. And then shortly into the investigation, we received confirmation that the Entwistle car was in the central parking garage at Logan Airport. And as a follow-up to that, we received information that a Neil Entwistle had boarded a flight with a one-way ticket and no luggage to London. And so during that time, we were conducting interviews back here of Rachel's mom and stepfather, Joe and Priscilla Matarazzo.
And what did they have to say, the in-laws have to say about their son-in-law, Neil Entwistle?
There was a young couple that were in love that had met over in England and had come over here to live. And we had information that Neil had good employment and they were trying to establish themselves as a loving husband and wife with a new baby.
So when you, as an investigator, found that Entwistle had gone to London and ended up at his parents' house in Worksop in Nottingham, I understand you made the call to that house to speak to him, to inform him of what had happened.
Yes. Once we confirmed that he was home, it was just natural for us to at least place a phone call. And the premise of the call was we just had no idea what Neil knew. Is he in trouble? Is he in danger? Is he involved? All those things were wide open.
What did he say?
At the beginning of that conversation, I informed him that we had a serious situation and a death of his daughter and his wife. He confirmed that he knew about the deaths before he left.
What did he tell you had happened prior to that in the morning?
Well, he said he went out and did some errands. So he gave us a couple of stores that he had supposedly went to after having fed Lillian in the morning and then placing Lillian back in bed with Rachel. And then he said he came back a couple of hours later. And when he came back, there was nobody downstairs, which he kind of told us was a little bit odd. And that when he went upstairs, when he first saw them, saw Rachel still in bed.
What did he sound like, you know, having informed him that his wife and child were dead, and he said, I already know that. What was his demeanor on the phone?
He was pretty matter of fact for the answers. And he told me, I know. He was pretty just straightforward with some of the answers and the information that he provided.
But his version of events conflicted with the true scenario.
When I walked in, I couldn't see Lily. I could only see Rachel, and she just looked asleep. The first thing I noticed was just her color. She was pale, and then as I got closer, I could see the blood, and that's when I saw Lily's the top half of the face was out, and I pulled the covers back, and it was obvious that they weren't alive anymore.
Okay.
One of the things he said right from the beginning was that after discovering the bodies, he went to the kitchen and he took out, it's not a quote, but something about taking out a knife and he was going to hurt himself, but he couldn't.
I went downstairs and I took one of the knives out of the block of knives I had in the kitchen. Maybe I could. You know, but I just didn't have the courage to do it. I think I pondered on that for a minute. I then got in the car.
Did Entwistle give any explanation as to how he had ended up at Logan Airport with no luggage, but coincidentally had his passport in his pocket?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly didn't give any valid or plausible explanation for it, but he did provide information that he felt alone, in need of having to get back home to his family. It was a strange explanation as to, this is how you find your wife and infant, and you don't call for help, you don't have any interaction with your in-laws here, you hop on a plane with just enough to get you home. And he provided no information throughout that conversation that there was any reason for any of this to have occurred. But the ironic part of that conversation was that he really gave us a good base to work off of, which was great from an investigative standpoint, because we took what he said and then we worked off it. It wasn't until we got more involved in interviews and forensics examinations that we really started to uncover a lot of deceptive behavior that was going on by this person in his life and in this family.
The deaths of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle had turned into a murder inquiry. The prime suspect was Neil Entwistle, who had many questions to answer. I'm on my way to meet Jerry Leone, the district attorney at that time who oversaw the investigation.
Hi, Jerry. My name is Jackie Morton. I'm a former detective with the Metropolitan Police in London. And I'm over in the United States revisiting the case of Neil Entwistle. Could you spare me some time to talk about the case?
Hi, this is Jerry Leone calling for Jackie Morton. Hello, Jackie. Yes, that's no problem at all. I got your message. I'd be delighted to meet with you.
Jerry, on the 20th of January 2006, it was alleged that Neil Entwistle murdered his wife, Rachel, and their nine-month-old daughter, Lillian, in their house in Hopkinton. And you, at that time, were the district attorney. How did you end up with this particular case to prosecute?
As the elected district attorney, at that time, I was responsible for all cases in the office. I would usually go to every single scene. In this case, particularly, I remember it was the day after my son's birthday, and I live in Hopkinton. So I was paged to the scene of the town I lived in to just see a crime scene, which was just an unspeakable crime.
So when you first saw the scene, what were your thoughts as to what had happened?
So I wasn't called to the scene until later, when the first cursory search and then the second search had been done. You go through the crime scene with the detectives, and you make whatever observations you can there, but you're also forming in your mind what your opening and closing is going to be from the first day you get on that crime scene.
Without any prime suspects at that point.
Right. Right. You start to, you know, you see the scene as it was, as soon as anybody could, and you make mental observations and you take notes, and some of those things come back to be part of your presentation before a jury.
When did Neil Entwistle become a prime suspect?
A prime suspect is when the evidence started to mount around who had been in the home, who had had access to Rachel and Lillian, and his whereabouts, because it became very curious very quickly.
And when he fled to England, he didn't want to be extradited back to the USA. So for all his defense of murder, suicide by his wife, he doesn't want to come back, he doesn't want to be extradited, and he's trying to escape from London still. That's not kind of, you know, the behavior, is it, of a man who says, well, it was nothing to do with me, it was down to my wife. And how that would leave an impact on Rachel's own family, for them to kind of think for a second that their own daughter had killed herself and her child. It's just...
His actions after the fact went beyond consciousness of guilt. In fact, it's cemented and solidified in people's minds that he, in fact, did do this unspeakable act.
Sure, because he fled to England, he fled back to his parents having bought a one-way ticket. He had previously rented a kind of 4x4 BMW, left that in the airport with the keys tucked under the seat. He had no intention of coming back, did he?
It certainly seems like his, not only was it calculated, was it intentional, but once he left and was free of the United States, he wasn't coming back.
With the evidence mounting against him, Neil Entwistle became a wanted man, and the US authorities were desperate to find and question him. Police efforts were soon focused on extraditing him from the UK. To find out how events unfolded next, I want to speak to retired Lieutenant James Connolly, who came on board with the case.
Hi, James. This is Jackie Moulton. I understand you had the task of locating Entwistle, but your investigation uncovered a lot about his life. I'd be really interested to hear more.
Hi, Jackie. This is Jim Conley. Yes, we're very interested in speaking to Entwistle, as our investigation revealed that he was not who he appeared to be. If you like, we could meet to discuss this case.
When you made some inquiries about Neil Entwistle living in your country, what did you establish in relation to his work, his financial situation, and personal aspects of him?
Through computer searches, forensic searches of the computer, we determined that the Entwistle were deeply in debt, well over $30,000. Neil was not working and didn't have any prospects, so financially they were in a tough shape.
So we've got a picture of a man heavily in debt, done some searches on the internet and I think for extramarital affairs, would that be right?
Correct.
So as far as the evidence is concerned against Neil Entwistle, you have got the bodies. I understand that you also had DNA evidence and that there was some evidence in relation to the gun that was used.
Correct.
Did he call for help 911 at all?
No.
Did he call Rachel's parents to say what had happened?
He called the next night. First, his dad called Joe Matarazzo. He spoke to Mr. Matarazzo, and then Neil called a little bit later.
And the gun that was used, Entwistle returned, I understand, to the family home of Rachel's parents.
Yes, this is the gun that Joe Matarazzo told him, showed him how to shoot the weapon in the fall. He took him to a range a couple times, took Neil shooting, showed him how to use it. On the weapon, on the grip, there was handler DNA, what we call handler DNA. There was DNA from Neil Entwistle.
And was there any explanation given by Entwistle to his father-in-law?
Other than that he came and found the bodies that way and just didn't know what to do and panicked and left.
In my experience, investigations that cross international borders can be delicate affairs where procedures need to be followed. Before I left the UK, I went to visit retired Detective Sergeant Gary Flood to get an insight into the British perspective on the situation.
Hi, Gary, this is Jackie Moulton, formerly of the Met. I know you were with Scotland Yard Specialist Expedition Unit at the time of the Neil Entwistle case, so I'd really like to find out more about your role, if that was possible.
Hi, Jackie. It's Gary Flood returning your call. Yes, I dealt with the arrest and extradition of Neil Entwistle. It was a very high-profile and tragic case. I'm happy to meet up and discuss.
Gary, what does the name Neil Entwistle mean to you?
Neil Entwistle was one of the most high-profile, media intense requests we have on the extradition unit in 2006. I was a supervisor on the Scotland Yard extradition unit, where we had a national responsibility to seek out fugitives that are wanted in countries we had extradition arrangements with. I read and listened to reports of a murder in Boston over the weekend where a body has been found, and that the main, it wasn't a suspect at the time, person of interest, the husband of the murder victim and child, had fled Boston and was back in the UK. So suspecting this will probably come our way if he turned into a suspect, I then made inquiries with British Airways. We confirmed that he arrived in the UK on the flight from Boston on a Saturday evening and managed to make contact with the investigators in Boston. So we just wanted to be ahead of the game and certainly let the Americans know what can and what can't be done, because it is a complex matter. And the US guys, were just, there was nothing they could do, and they just went home.
And at what point did he become a prime suspect? Was that to do with forensic evidence?
It was, yeah. What happened is that we got indication that there had further evidence had been obtained by the Americans in the form, I understand, of DNA on the gun that was used to murder Rachel and Lillian. And that changed the situation in America. It was the, her DNA was found on the muzzle, his on the, I understand, on the trigger. And that gave them, that set them over the line to be able to go to a judge in Boston and obtained a warrant for his arrest for the murder.
When forensic evidence finally revealed that the gun Entwistle had returned to his in-laws was the murder weapon, Gary Flood and his team were able to act. By now, Entwistle had left his parents' home in Nottingham and travelled to London. What followed was a cat-and-mouse chase in London's underground.
How did you arrest him, and where was he when he was arrested?
I made a phone call, made a decision to phone his father. He explained that he was with his friend, Dash, in London, located Dash Munzeen's address in Notting Hill. We then rushed from Scotland Yard to that address. He wasn't at home, so I then phoned Dash Munzeen to say, where is Neil? And he then said, I've just dropped him off at Ladbroke Grove underground station. He's just gone on the platform now. So we then rushed and met Dash Munzeen, who was at the bottom of the stairs entrance to the underground station. So we just missed him. We were aware that three stops was Paddington, the main hub. So we got to Paddington, the chance of us locating him there would have been quite hard. Fortunately, there was a underground control room at Ladbroke Grove. And one of my officers, DC Martin Lewis, done some great work, spoke to the control room, who arranged for the train to be stopped at the next available station, which was Royal Oak, two stops, one stop before Paddington. So we then rushed to Royal Oak, and when we got there, the train was stuck at the platform with all the doors shut. And towards the end of the train, I noticed that Neil Entwistle was sitting down with his back to us.
How could you recognise him?
Well, we knew for the media, he'd been all over the media. We knew, we had photographs of him, we knew what he looked like. So we just put our thumbs up to the driver who opened the doors, and then we went in and took him off the train onto the platform and arrested him.
What did he say?
Very quiet, very compliant. Almost resigned to it happening. Might have had some understanding of the game was up, so to speak. We arrested, handcuffed him, took him to Charing Cross Police Station. On the journey, I rang Jim to give him the news that we'd found him on a tube train and he's been arrested. He was delighted and relieved, to say the least.
Did you get any kind of indication what kind of guy he was?
He was a bit odd, without a doubt. He was, it's very, as though he may have had Asperger's or something similar, because he didn't seem to comprehend him being a suspect for the murder in Boston. The unusual thing about him is that when we searched his bag, he had a little blue plastic bag, and inside that he had torn out from the Daily Star sexual adverts. There was also a note to editors of newspapers seeking the highest bidder for his story. The following day, he consented to his extradition, which meant once that consent was given, we could make arrangements to get him extradited over to America.
So where in your career, Gary, does Neil Entwistle sit?
It's high up there because of the nature of the horrific murder of a young baby in a mother's arms for what appears to be little reason. We will probably never know why he's done it.
Neil Entwistle is one of the hardest, personally, for me to comprehend, because I just can't get my head around why a man would kill his own 9-month-old baby and his wife.
Yeah, and it's still, well, we're now 13 years later, he's still in the media. He's still denying it. And his parents are still convinced that he hasn't done it.
It must be very difficult, mustn't it, for the parents to look at their son through a different lens.
Yes, but I don't think they've looked through that lens yet.
We are left with only Neil Entwistle knowing what happened on that fateful day in Hopkinton.
Indeed.
Neil Entwistle found himself back on US soil. I'm returning to see James Connolly about how events unfolded.
When he eventually came back to the United States, I understand that he freely came back.
He did not fight extradition, that's correct. He came back voluntarily, but he was under arrest.
Of course, he was under arrest.
The U.S. Marshals had a plane, they had a private plane, and they went and got Entwistle and they brought him back.
Were you allowed to interview him as to what happened on that fateful day?
I went on the plane and I advised Entwistle of his rights and asked him if he wanted to speak to us, and he did not want to speak to us. He wanted to talk to a lawyer.
What happens then, from police point of view?
Once he invokes his right to an attorney, we can't say a word to him. If he wants to make a statement or say something, he's welcome to say it, but we can't pursue the questions, and it's we really can't ask any questions. It's a fine line in the United States. Once they invoke, we're done talking to them. We'll have to wait till he speaks to an attorney.
Was there any point that you observed that Entwistle showed any form of remorse?
I never saw it, but I do know that he didn't come back for the wake or the funerals of his wife and child.
Neil Entwistle appears to have been living a double life, but this crime is so abhorrent, it leaves many questions. The biggest is, how could a man turn on his own wife and baby in such a cold-blooded way? Someone who may have some answers is forensic psychologist Dr. Julian Boone.
Julian, out of all of the cases that I've looked at on the real prime suspects, the case of Neil Entwistle I have found truly distressing. Is this a family annihilator?
In his case, he was entirely psychopathic and was living the American dream on the basis of all surface and no substance.
Is that psychopathic?
Yes, very much. And recklessly spending. Now, we know that he had multiple credit cards, all but one of which was entirely maxed out. He had literally reached the end of his rope in terms of finances and in terms of credibility. Another trait of the psychopath is that they are prolific liars and completely conscience-free about doing it. We're talking about manipulative lies and self-serving lies. You have there a psychopath and a narcissist. And if you see parents who are that doting on him, you can see where both those traits came from. Narcissism will be apparent because you're constantly told you're wonderful, you're the best thing since sliced bread. When you get out into the wider world, you can suddenly have an abrupt shock to the psychological system when nobody else thinks you're that wonderful. And so therefore you have to act. And it was all a total facade, a facade that he couldn't keep up indefinitely because he hadn't got the money to do it.
Even if Entwistle's account of the death of his wife and child was true, then to my mind, his behaviour was nothing short of callous and cruel. He seemed totally emotionally disengaged from what had happened. I'm still keen to find out if the final act of these tragic events, Entwistle's trial, reveals any insight into what motivated him to commit these atrocious crimes. I'm going to pay Jerry Leone one last visit. As the district attorney and one of the leading prosecutors in the country, he has dealt with hundreds of cases. He's in prime position to assess Entwistle's character.
Jerry, when Entwistle was listening to the evidence that was being presented, what was his demeanor?
It was largely unaffected. I think that's the best way to put it. He could have been watching a ball game. He could have been, watching TV. He could have been sitting on the back porch looking out over the yard. It was just very unaffected.
It is absolutely so appalling that a man can kill his child. Is there a drive within you to kind of fight for justice as a prosecutor?
I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a father of two children. And I've prosecuted baby murders. I've prosecuted murders of spouses. It's difficult to try and fathom how somebody would do something like that. But it's as if when you come across evidence at a scene and you have a dead body, it's really at that point, your experience tells you it's evidence. As a prosecutor, you really have to, on some level, be dispassionate about what it is you're trying to get accomplished, because otherwise that can get in the way of what you're trying to accomplish, which is justice in a conviction.
Do you recall how long the jury were out discussing the case?
You know, I don't recall exactly how long the deliberations were. My senses and my memory was, for the amount of time one would have thought for them to have gone through the evidence, that the verdict came back shortly thereafter, so it wasn't an unreasonable amount of time.
And what was the actual verdict that they came back with?
Is the defendant guilty or not guilty?
Guilty of murder in the first degree of Rachel Entwistle. Guilty of murder in the first degree of Lillian Entwistle.
So two verdicts of murder in the first degree, one for killing Rachel and one for killing Lillian. And he received two life sentences, consecutive life sentences, which is, under Massachusetts law, mandatory.
When the verdict was read, Rachel's parents and the grandparents of Lillian, who had attended every day of the court case, got the opportunity to speak about the pain they had endured.
Neil, you have been judged today by a jury of your peers on earth, but one day you will face the ultimate judgment of your horrific deeds. Betrayals.
Suffering does not begin to describe what we have been enduring without our beloved Rachel and Lillian, who gave our lives such purpose and meaning. I have lost two generations of my family.
And even Jerry Leone made no secret of his disgust and horror at the actions of Neil Entwistle as the verdict was reached.
I condemn Neil Entwistle for compounding the unspeakable nature of what he has done by disparaging the memory of his wife and vilifying the entire Matarazzo family by his decisions during the course of this trial.
I think, again, as we speak now, that Neil Entwistle is in jail in the United States and still, as I understand it, protesting his innocence. The evidence is overwhelming, absolutely overwhelming.
You'd like to think it was unbelievable, because unbelievable would mean it wouldn't happen. And unfortunately, it did. Part of the problem is we try to rationalize it, right? We try to look at this as rational human beings and say, there's got to be some reason. And it makes us feel better if there's some reason. It's almost more difficult that we can't come to some rational reason in a human being's mind about why he would have done this. And there isn't in a crime like this. There just isn't. It's an incredible cowardice and extreme selfishness.